Hello and welcome aboard the Battleship Pretension. I am Scott Nye.
I'm David Bax.
And thank you for listening. David, how's it going? You got
Yes.
the fan on, the weather's finally improved.
Yeah, the fan is on. Also, we just got a brand new washer and dryer. This is not me bragging. I'm actually like pissed about it that we had to do it. Our old washer crapped out, and it's sort of like you want to get them as a package deal, I guess.
Sure.
Anyway, so I'm actually doing a full load of laundry right now for the first time, and this new washer makes like I don't know. It makes weird noises, but like I keep checking on it. It looks like everything's going right, but it sounds like it's not working. But maybe this is
What,
just
like very metallic noises, heavy clunks?
no, it's more like a whirring that it's like it sounds like it's trying to start and isn't. But
Oh, interesting.
it is working. But it's also like it's a washing machine that is it doesn't have I've never had a washing machine b before that didn't have like the big center pole coming out of the middle. It doesn't have that. It just has a big basin.
Oh, we have the stacked, so we're not familiar. We abandoned the center
Oh.
pole long ago.
So you've got a see, I'm still a top loader. You're a front loader on your washing machine.
We sure are. Love the
Yeah,
front
okay.
loader life.
No, so yeah, so it seems to work based on different mechanics and it's making a weird whirring noise. But every time I check on it's like you'd think there'd be some sort of warning light or something we're going wrong, but it seems to be just going along,
We
getting us to the place it needs.
Had some dishwasher issues that I think I resolved, and we just did our first load today. I was very, very worried about it.
Yeah, it's nerve-wracking. Anyway, so that's what's going on right now. Yeah, it's warm. I'm doing laundry. Just a super hip Wednesday night. But you know what I did for a super hip Tuesday night is I went to see a Marlon Brando double feature at the New Beverly.
Oh, very cool.
And I had a couple of thoughts based on the experience.
Well, what were the movies?
Oh, sorry. It was On the Waterfront, which I had of course seen before,
Yeah.
and The Wild One, which I had never seen before.
I've still not seen it myself. All
Yeah, you know what? It's not that great.
right.
I mean, it's like he's cool, he's great, he's Marlon
Yeah.
Brando, but yeah, not that great of a movie. Especially like after you've just watched On the Waterfront, it's not going
Sure.
to hold up. But couple of thoughts I had. This is just a minor digression because over time, just talking to you about this, you have won me over a little bit to the like benefits of seeing things on celluloid.
Hell yeah.
And that is especially true in a case like it was last night, where both prints are in fantastic condition.
Glad to hear it.
Because I have also been to screenings at the New Beverly, where it's like, I'm wondering, is this like dogmatic insistence on 35 millimeter? Like this print isn't that good a condition. Would it be a better like service to the film to see a good DCP than a bad print? But then I also wonder, like these movies that I'm talking about are like movies like Coonskin and Amok, which are like maybe no one's made DCPs of those. I don't know. Like they're not; those aren't very like big titles. But Amok was like I would say one of the worst pieces of like film that I mean, it's a cool movie. It was the back half of
Okay.
it. The double feature was the Bloodstained Bride, which is a kick-ass movie. And then yeah, Amok, which is like kind of a witchy, I don't know, Euro erotica horror type thing from like the early 70s, and it looked like the whole print had just been dipped in grenadine. It was just so pink.
Well, someone has digitized it because you can watch it on YouTube.
Oh, okay. Anyway, but anyway, that wasn't even what I was thinking about. What I was thinking about is I mentioned that I had seen On the Waterfront before, but I had never seen it with an audience. And I think this is
Sure.
something that I've come around on, is that like the difficulties or the risks of seeing a movie amidst other human beings are more than worth it, in most cases.
Oh, yeah.
Because yeah, On the Waterfront's good, but a thing that I had like not really thought about, and this is not the first time I've had this experience of like being familiar with a movie like an old sort of like classic drama like On the Waterfront, and then seeing it with a crowd and realizing that it's funnier than I thought it was.
Oh, yeah. You see something with a crowd. That's usually what you find out.
Yeah, there's like early on, you know, there's a guy, Joey Doyle gets killed in like the opening scene. And then the next morning at the dock, Joey Doyle's dad gives his coat to another worker who needs a new coat. And then a worker is like, oh, God knows I need it. This coat of mine has more holes in it than the Pittsburgh infield. And then another guy walks by and he takes off his coat and goes, here, I want you to have my coat. The coat that he was just like disparaging gets passed off to another guy. And then there's also the part where Eva Marie Saint's dad is like complaining about how she like would take in sick animals and care for like the mangiest, scraggliest cat would be the one that she loved.
Sure.
Like, and he's like, look at him, the bum. And it's just a shot of like just a normal cat. That got a huge laugh in the audience.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Because you're expecting some like, yeah, mangy, you know, two-headed cat or something. And it's just like a normal cat sitting on the bed.
Yeah.
Anyway, totally. So that was just some minor thoughts I had of the benefits of seeing things with an audience is like,
yeah.
Well, both of those things, if I were watching, and I'm sure when I did watch at home, I was probably like smiling or like, oh, that's nice.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Like that big audience reaction to a laugh in a movie like On the Waterfront that people don't necessarily think of as a funny movie it's a revelation. It's great to see new things, and part of that is not just seeing it big, but seeing it with other people.
Yeah, for sure. No, I have a couple of those from this past week. So I saw the first Omen twice in theaters, and both times was reminded of, I hadn't seen a horror movie with a big crowd in a while. Most of the time I'll see them in the afternoon with my friend Gray, who were both kind of like between jobs. And so we'll go to the afternoon horror movies. And so there's like, you know, maybe 10 other dudes kind of like passing the time. But it'd been a while since I saw a horror movie with a big crowd. And so you get that great like scream at a jump scare, but then everyone kind of laughing at how much they screamed about it, which is always like kind of fun way to take off the edge.
Yeah.
Took a big swing last week and saw Picnic, which is a show at the Egyptian with Karina Longworth and Patton Oswalt talking afterwards. Okay. And that's one of my favorite movies of all time and a great melodrama, but definitely has a lot of moments where like people could laugh inappropriately, but they really weren't, and they're mostly into it, and they kind of laughed at the stuff that is a little heightened, but also like I think is meant to be a little like characters acting out and characters like kind of betraying their sense of self with the kind of certainty they express. So it's kind of like a cool way to reflect, yeah, what we're all feeling. And then I also saw Panic Room, which is like, it's a thriller and it's tense, but it's kind of like a light thriller. You know, there's not really the sense of like, this could all go upend for everybody. But the woman next to me was like edge of her seat, like clenching her teeth, like doing this a lot. And it was great.
I love that. I love
yeah.
that. Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to think of the last time, like big horror movie. I saw Talk to Me with a Comic-Con crowd. That was, people were super into it.
I missed that one.
That was fun. And then, I regret that I didn't see Barbarian with a crowd. I saw Barbarian at home.
Still that was really fun.
That would have been fun. But Smile was really great with a crowd.
Yeah, that one I actually saw with a pretty full. I saw that at night, and yeah, it was pretty full. And some of those scares, man, yeah, that worked.
Yeah, yeah, Smile, cool movie. All right, well, before we go any further, I want to tell you about TweakedAudio.com. TweakedAudio.com is where you go for professional quality earbuds in a variety of stylish styles and colorful colors. They look great. They sound great. I use them each and every day of my life. I listen to a lot of great music today, but I really wanted to highlight... and as I've said, I'm still like... Okay. Window into my music listening, or at least my music, like keeping up on new music.
Thing, okay.
Is that I like... read like a couple of blogs, usually Stereo Gum and then nocleansinging.com for like extreme metal stuff. And based on what I'm reading, I add stuff to a playlist, right? And what always happens in the spring, well, starting in the winter, is I spend so much time, as I do with movies, cramming stuff from the end of the year and even catching up on stuff from the end of the year.
Sure.
That I start the year, so here we are, April is the fourth month of the year, but I'm still like a month behind on music because I put it on this playlist and I listen to it in order. I'm gonna mention a new album which actually came out a month ago, but it's technically a debut album. The artist's name is Tierra Whack. People who have really great memories for these tweaked ad reads. Might know that I've talked about her before, but I've talked about her EPs in the past. I've known who she is for at least 3 or 4 years, but this is technically her debut album. She's only put out EPs up to now. It's called Worldwide Whack, and it's great. It is like, not to oversell it, but it is like an album of the year contender already. For me, it's so much fun. It's so groovy. It's very funny. And also, I will admit this put it over the edge a little bit. It has a song called Movies with two O's.
Okay.
And it's about how, I guess it's like she's talking to her boyfriend who never takes her to the movies and talking about other guys who took her to the movies and how much she liked that. And at one point she says, David took me to see The Matrix, got me picking out a gown. So a guy named David took her to The Matrix.
Perfect.
And she wants to marry him for that. So that definitely is maybe part of the reason I loved the album so much, but it's a really, really, really fun album.
I mean, I'm disappointed that there wasn't some sort of cow reference in here with the two O's. That's where I thought this was leading.
Oh, no, that'd be funny. No, I think it's just
all about Twister or Brother Where Art Thou.
Top Secret. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Top Secret for sure.
Okay. Yeah. This is our next episode. Canon. Cow movies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Famous movie cows. Heathers.
I don't remember the cow Heathers.
When she goes out on a date, she goes on like a double date with the two dumb like jocks, and they get drunk and they like attempt to tip a cow, but they're drunk and they just slip in the mud and fall on their faces, I think.
Okay, this is ringing a bell now.
Yeah. Good movie. Wait, let me finish up the ad read and I have something else I want to talk about. So this Tierra Whack album, Worldwide Whack, sounded great on my tweakedaudio.com earbuds. They're available at a low, low price at tweakedaudio.com. But if you use the offer code pretension at checkout, you get 1/3 off that low, low price and no shipping charges. So please go to tweakedaudio.com and use the offer code pretension.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about all from the comfort of your home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Bite.
Okay, we're back, and before we get into the topic, there's actually another top of show thing that I wanted to talk about, which is that over at the great movie list resource, They Shoot Pictures, Don't They? Sure. There's a new list called, it's called like Beyond the Sight and Sound Canon, and basically...
Oh, yeah.
So I just mentioned because I was one of the people asked to contribute, which is very nice, they asked to nominate up to 100 films, which of course I nominated 100 films, that not only aren't on the Sight and Sound list, but didn't get a single vote in the 2022 yeah. Sight and Sound poll. So obviously they provided a spreadsheet of here's every movie so you could check it against. But even with that, it took a while to compile the list. And anyway, Heathers is one of the ones that I nominated. I can't remember if it made the list, which is like 1,000-something movies, much like the They Shoot Pictures, Don't They list. But it's a really fun thing to look through and see which movies. I intentionally, because we had a Patreon mailbag question you and I recently, Scott, which is about like what newer movies do we think will like
sure
make their debut on the 2032. I intentionally didn't pick. I didn't pick anything even from the 90s. I was like 80s and earlier was
oh wow
my entire thing. A lot of people definitely voted for a lot of more recent movies, and it's interesting to see which ones show up.
Good for them. Stake your claim, I say. Yeah.
Anyway, but
you should post your list on Twitter or something.
I mean, I retweeted the film stages link to it, and you can find the individual ballots there. So on my Twitter, and you can find my individual ballot. I said on Twitter you can drag me for it, but also you would have to have the list of what I couldn't vote for to really drag me, I guess. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, say, how could you not pick?
It's like, well, somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, so it's a super fun list, even though, I mean, here I am at like the actual, like, they shoot pictures, don't they, list. I've only seen like 60% of, you know, and to, like, say, here's 1,000 more, like, you know, movies. Anyway, so go check that out. So, all right, let's get into it, shall we? I'm very excited for this episode. It's probably going to be on the short side, though, I think.
It's a little one-sided, so there's that.
And also, it was a short festival, and I didn't even go to all of it. But, you know, obviously, Los Angeles's AFI Film Festival is still going. I was going to say going strong, but it's not as strong as it used to be. But as we've talked about in the podcast before, most festivals aren't as strong as they used to be. But LA used to also have the Los Angeles Film Festival. Hasn't since 2018. 2018 was the last year of the LA Film Festival. So it's been without a serious, like, city-branded film festival Los Angeles has until now, where I've already forgotten the name of the two people who founded the Los Angeles Festival of Movies, but it's in concurrence with Mezzanine.
Micah Gottlieb is one of them. I'm loose acquaintances with him, so I know him.
Yeah, that's the one I remembered too, so I feel bad for the woman who also introduced movies there. Anyway, Susan something? I can't remember. Anyway, the Los Angeles Festival of Movies made its debut appearance on Los Angeles calendars this past weekend, and I went and saw a bunch of movies, by which I mean six. I went
and they only showed 12,
probably only 12, probably only a dozen movies.
Yeah.
And yeah, there were basically like a couple things I didn't bother going to see them because I had seen them at Sundance.
Sure.
And then a couple of the things were schedule conflicts, but I saw one movie on Friday, and then I spent the entire day Saturday seeing all six of movies that were all five movies, well, six with a short, that were programmed on Saturday. So I've got six movies to talk about, but we actually, well, I guess, what do you, you didn't go, what are your, are you as excited as I am about Los Angeles Film Festival having a, or Los Angeles having a new festival with the city's name in the title?
I mean, I'm always excited about anything that gets people excited about movies. It sounded like this, I mean, you tell me, from the outside, it sounded like this was a pretty good success. My reasons for not going strictly monetary, and I did have family in town this past weekend, which made it a little tough. But I was very intrigued by it. I've been following Micah's screening series, Mezzanine Films, since its inception a couple years ago. And even before that, he did some programming at UCLA that I attended, and he's a really smart programmer and has a really good sense of what the city could be interested in, a good sense of how to get a good audience for it. So I was already excited on that front, and I read some articles about their design of it, and I really appreciated that it wasn't, their aim, as they put it, isn't to like create the next Sundance. It's not to create a festival that like agency folks can spend a quote unquote work day at it. They purposely scheduled it so that it could be attended by people who have 9-to-5 jobs and want to see movies in the evening. And the goal of the festival is to show cool movies to residents of LA, which is what a film festival should do. And in addition to that, they just programmed some stuff that looks super cool that, you know, is either stuff that I have seen and like, or, well, not in one case, but or want to see on soon. And in one case, I know that one of the films is coming out like next month, and so I'm already excited for that. And then they have some new restorations in there of stuff that I hadn't heard of, and which it really isn't available in any other channels. I did look to see if some of the stuff they were showing had popped up before, but it really hasn't. So I appreciate that they stuck at the fore of that instead of showing, you know, restorations of more famous films that have been out there for a while. They kind of kept on the track of what Mezzanine has been doing, which is showing stuff a little bit, or really more than a little bit, outside of even like the art house mainstream.
I got to see one major movie that I had been really looking forward to, and it turned out to be great. And then a couple of other new movies I didn't know anything about. And then, yeah, three restorations. So I saw three new movies and three restorations. By the way, so the full board is Micah Gottlieb, Sarah Winchell, Glenn Pease, Anise Elias, Becca Rieckmann, Pauline Kreitz, Eleni Chung, Joshua Adam Fu, and Allison Bunce. But there's a whole other advisory board beyond that that I'm not going to go into. Sure. That has some names that you, you the listener, may, might even know. All right.
Yeah, those so advisory boards, it's like, I don't know, what are they really doing?
So let's start. So the opening night film, which, so there were three venues. I only went to 2220 Arts and Archives in historic Filipino town. That's not being overly laudatory or exaggerating.
That's just what they insist on calling it.
The neighborhood is officially called historic Filipino town. But they had opening closing night movies at the Vidiots Theater, which is called the Eagle in Eagle Rock. And then they did the shorts programs at a pretty new place called Now Instant Image Hall in Chinatown, which I have not been to. I was going to go see a movie there and it sold out because I think it's very small.
I've seen the inside photos. I had only heard of this venue very recently, but yeah, I looked at some photos of it. It's like, that is a tiny little screening room. That's the other cool thing, is that they did all these screenings kind of on the east side of LA, which is really kind of up and coming for cinema.
So very cool. So the opening night film was Jane Schoenbrunn's I Saw the TV Glow, which I saw the TV Glow at Sundance. You saw the TV Glow at a press screening. So since we both see, and listeners have already heard me talk about it on the Sundance wrap up episode, but I want to talk about it again here just because I want to hear, because I know you felt differently than I did about it, and I kind of want to hear you out.
Sure. So I was rooting for this movie. I loved We're All Going to the World's Fair. It was like just outside my top 10 that year. Was very excited for her follow-up film, and seemed to be kind of trading in the same milieu, had some of the same sort of aesthetic markings, seemed to be the kind of next logical step of, like, you make a very indie movie and then you kind of like take that same approach and take it to a bigger scale. In this case, the bigger scale is like A24. Excuse me. And so it's very much.
I'm gonna interrupt real quick to point out that there's a bunch of, there are multiple live performances of music in the movie.
Yeah.
And apparently that was one of the ways that Jane Schoenbrunn decided to spend the bigger budget that she got from A24, was like, perfect. I'm gonna commission some of my favorite, like, currently working musical acts to write and perform songs for the movie.
Yeah, that's awesome. I didn't know that. Those sequences are effective, but at the same time come up against some of my reservations about the film. I mean, just from the start, I would say the film kind of bounced off me on a visceral level that I had a hard time overcoming. So it's about these two people, Justice Smith, and I can't remember.
Bridget Lundy Payne.
Yes.
Is their name.
Yeah, who was on some TV show, but otherwise, I'm not familiar with their work.
Bridget Lundy Payne was, I think they played Keanu Reeves' daughter in Bill and Ted Face the Music.
Right. Okay. Yes, I did see them in that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which was like, I mean, both of those daughter roles were kind of nothing roles. You like the film better than I do. Maybe you feel differently, but
no, yeah, I thought they were both really good at, like, I thought they were both really funny. It was Bridget Lundy Payne and Samara Weaving.
Right.
And they both got that, like, the, like, dumb enthusiasm of Bill and Ted that makes Bill and Ted so endearing. I think they, both of them, captured that. So I Fair enjoyed enough. Them in the movie.
So anyway, getting back to the film at hand, is Justice Smith and Bridget Lundy Payne. And at the start of the movie, the Justice Smith character is played by a different younger actor because his character starts the film entering high school. Am I right in this?
You've seen it more recently than I have.
Well, I know.
Well, it's only been 3 months, but yeah, I don't remember exactly.
Yeah, he's a younger teenager, maybe just barely a teenager, might even be in middle school, but kind of just like runs across Bridget Lynn Payne's character in a school hallway and discovers that, now I'm not misgendering here, Bridget Lynn Payne's character is a woman, so I'm going to use she in reference to the character. Discovers she's a fan of this TV show called The Pink Opaque, which is very much like one of those like WBUPN shows from the 90s, and the film starts in the 90s, I should say.
Yeah, 96. And I know that Buffy the Vampire Slayer isn't the only touch point that,
but
that
it feels like a major one. Going.
But it is a major one. I mean, like, it also wasn't the only show to have, like, because it was, they would have bands play on the show too. Like, you know, and Beverly Hills 90210 did that as well. It was like, oh, you're on the WB, you have to have like bands that are signed to Warner Brothers Records that were trying to break play at the club. But also, and I know as a not Buffy fan, you wouldn't have known this, but when we actually see clips from The Pink Opaque, the fake show within I Saw the TV Glow, the credit font is the exact same font as Buffy the Vampire
Slayer. Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So my inkling that it was heavily Buffy inspired was not not incorrect.
Yeah.
So when I say this film kind of bounced off me right away, I mean, it has an investment in a sliver of fandom that I was never really a part of or never really that into. And then I never found the film involved me in a way past that assumption of fandom. And maybe that's fine. Maybe it's like, it's a film for people who were obsessed with these 90s genre shows, and I'm just outside of its audience. But my general hope would be that a film could expand its emotional investment beyond kind of what it's speaking to, but it just kept doubling down on that. And like, by the time, and this isn't a spoiler, but towards the end, someone uses the notion of DVD chapters as like this poetic idea of time passing. And I'm like, this is thin metaphor soup you're dwelling in here. And I think what made We're All Going to the World's Fair so effective is its sort of minimalist approach, both in the writing, which kind of like was constantly teasing the notion of this online community without fully explicating it. And also in the performances, which weren't like so, I guess melodramatic is overstating what I Saw the TV Glow doing, but it has a more kind of like dramatic indulgence to it, which could be fine. But I just felt that I Saw the TV Glow did not have a handle on either, that its writing was kind of like very faux poetic, very pretentious, and that the performances especially, and at this point I just think Justice Smith just isn't for me. I really think the performances are really at odds with what its potential could be, that they're too experienced to be amateurish in their approach, but not so experienced that they can make this kind of like drivelly writing into something really poetic and moving.
Oh man. Yeah. That's the last part I really have to disagree. I mean, I found the movie. I had, you know, there's a lot of chatter at Sundance on Twitter. And some on Blue Sky, it's still hanging in there. But, I had heard a lot of people finding, a lot of trans or non-binary people sort of finding the metaphor really effective, and I think going in knowing that that's how people felt about it, I definitely see that metaphor, but I don't really want to speak that much to it because obviously I don't know what it's like to be a trans person.
I think we could say as much as like the Justice Smith character finds a strong identification in these female leads that he maybe wasn't expecting.
But I think the metaphor goes deeper than.
Oh, I definitely agree, but I think that gets into spoiler territory.
I think you're right. Now I'm losing. Okay, so in reading these tweets before I'd seen the movie, a lot of the talk was about how heartbreaking and devastating the end was. And I was surprised by a, not to get into spoilers, surprised by the way in which the ending was heartbreaking, and also surprised that even not having that that knowledge of what it is to be trans, that I found it so gutting and so devastating. And to me, Justice Smith's performance, the whole movie, but especially in those final couple scenes, that's sort of like a Chuck E. Cheese type of place, I was bowled over, not in a way that I want, not sad in the way I wanted to cry, but just like I felt hollowed out by the movie. It was really, really effective. And I think, I mean, I could argue, I don't know if I, this is kind of a specious argument, but it's maybe worth thinking about, that maybe Justice Smith in particular coming across a little false is a part of it, because his, you think of when someone who is trans is closeted, they're putting on a kind of gender performance. And so maybe he's not believable because he's not ever truly himself.
To extend
the trans metaphor, I don't know if that's true or not.
I think that can go far enough. I think until the end, where he's kind of so hollowed out that he's beyond any kind of affectation as a character. I mean, but as an actor, the affectation.
The very last scene is him stubbornly. I mean, we're getting into spoilers, but like he is stubbornly insisting on maintaining the performance.
I think he's trying to, but I think the character is too hollowed out to successfully do so.
Okay. Well, and let's get away from spoilers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, obviously, you know, we've just talked about movie X and how I don't like nostalgia. And I don't think this movie is like, when I saw that it was a period piece, I was a little nervous about that. I don't think the movie is resting purely on nostalgia, but I do think you're right that if I did not spend time being a fan of things like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, that maybe that sort of Tumblr style, like identification through fandom belonging, like,
yeah,
even though I was never like on Tumblr, a part of me does still identify or at least sympathize with that. But I also think the movie is beautiful to look at.
Yeah, it's just, you know, when it's pretty rare that that much style doesn't get over script and performance issues for me, but every now and again it does come up against it.
Yeah, yeah, it's not just the TV that glows. There's a lot of glow.
No, everything glows.
Fish tanks. There's glow in the dark sidewalk chalk, which is cool. So I'm really, really into this. To this movie, I wonder if it will be a thing once I have some distance from it. If I do think cinematically, I still think We're All Going to the World's Fair is the better achievement, but I Saw the TV Glow will probably be more near and dear to me.
Sure, I can totally see that. Yeah, I mean, I think for sure We're All Going to the World's Fair is much like. It speaks to a much broader audience, but I can see I Saw the TV Glow for those it hitting much harder.
All right. So that is not the end of movies that we've both seen, I think, right? We're going to have another one.
Okay. We will.
But it'll be a little while. We don't have that many movies to talk about, but yeah, the other one we've both seen is the last one I saw.
Gotcha.
So the movie I would say that I was most excited to see going into this, well, of the three new movies that I saw, was Gasoline Rainbow, which is the new film from the Ross brothers, Bill and Turner Ross. One of them is like the fourth, like Turner Ross the fourth or something, and Bill Ross.
Yeah, and for listeners, this is the one that will come out in early May. I think
May 10th,
both, both theatrically and maybe shortly thereafter streaming, but it's like they're pretty close together. Okay, so May 10th theatrically, May 31st on Mubi.
Yeah, it's a Mubi, and Mubi was a major sponsor. I have a new spiffy new Mubi tote, and
watch out.
There was a Mubi like bumper before every Mubi. Yeah, that's one thing that like as much as I love this film festival, it has the one problem of every film festival, which is that it's the same bumpers before every movie, and by the second time I see them, I'm so sick of them. So the Ross brothers, Bill and Turner Ross, had made Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets, which I think was on my top 10 2020, but it's definitely a great movie. And so their new one is called Gasoline Rainbow. I didn't stay for the Q&A for this, and I kind of wish I would have, because I have a lot of questions about how it was made. I haven't looked it up, but I mostly stayed for the Q&As actually, because it's not a festival where there's like something else to get to, because it was all at one place, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Normally I'm like booking after a screening because I want to make it, get in line for the next screening somewhere else, but like it was just here, so I just stayed for most of the Q&As, but I didn't stay for this one because I had to go grocery shopping.
Boring.
I stayed for the Q&A a different Q&A the next day, where the person being interviewed was French, and she was talking about how much she had liked Gasoline Rainbow. She said Gasoline Rainbow.
Love it.
And so I've kind of subconsciously been saying Gasoline Rainbow ever since. Gasoline Rainbow is a movie about five young adults who have just graduated high school, were introduced to them via their like high school ID cards, and decide these aren't kids who have like great prospects for the future. They're not going off to college. They know that the next step is just like staying in their small town and getting a job. So they decide to take a van trip from very much inner Eastern Oregon all the way to the coast. It's a made-up town, unfortunately, because I was like, I have to look up where Wiley, Oregon is, but I googled it and it's a made-up town. But it says it's 513 miles from the coast, so that's got to be like all the way into
Oregon's not wide enough to go much further. Let's see, but yeah. Continue talking, I'll get a sense of where it is.
But I've driven to Boise, Idaho a number of times in my life, and part of that does include about 100 miles of southeastern Oregon, and I can attest to the fact that there is fucking nothing there.
No.
I mean, I don't like Kansas gets a lot of like flack for being a boring state to drive through, and it is. I'm not saying it's not, but don't like dark horse candidate is eastern or southeastern Oregon. Anyway.
Okay, yeah, this is like about as far as you can get. So I found some random town on the eastern border, then directed it to one of the coastal towns I remembered, and it's just under 500 miles. So
okay, yeah. So the movie is just it's a road trip movie, and it has a lot. It reminded me in a lot of ways of American Honey, which is obviously like it's hard to find a better comparison than American Honey. This is why I want to know how it was made, because if you didn't see Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets, you should know that it presents itself as a documentary, but a lot more of it was not staged, but like sort of set up, I guess, manufactured in a way. So I'm wondering how much of that is true here, because everything seems so naturalistic with these kids, seems so improvised a lot of the time, that I wonder if it's a similar thing, if they like maybe they planned out this trip but they didn't tell the kids exactly what was going to happen or something and had them just react, which leads to a lot of very funny stuff. The movie is really, really funny.
To its production methods, one of the brothers, Turner, said, "We are desperate not to have this fucking conversation ever again."
Okay, then I'm glad I didn't stay for the internet. Maybe it would have gotten contentious. I am curious. But the movie is also, I mean, if you saw Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets, you know that they have an eye, but by putting them out on the road.
Sure.
There is so much beauty just like captured almost haphazardly. Sometimes it seems it can't be, but there's a part where they take a detour to these like, maybe you know because you're from Oregon.
Let's find out.
Basically, like what looked to me like salt flat type of things, just like a bare flat open space. But they come off on
specifically.
It, they come up on it at dawn, and the way the moonlight reflects off it, it really looks like in the middle of Oregon somehow they've discovered an ocean. And until the car, the truck, or the van rather, goes out and starts driving on this dirt, it literally looks like shimmery water until the moment the truck, the van starts driving on it. And there's just so much beauty like that in the movie. And as a Portland guy, they do eventually get to Portland, so you'll get to see some Portland stuff. But it's it's beautiful. It felt very much like, not in its production methods, which I know they don't want to have the conversation, not aesthetically, but emotionally, it felt very similar to Dazed and Confused. Because it has that sense of like, it captures that sense of being a kid and being reckless. And probably as an adult, I'm looking at them being like, you're being stupid, but also things just kind of tend to work out sometimes. And like, you know, you keep pushing and maybe you might find another party to go to. You might, like, there are multiple parts in this movie where they just like happen upon parties that are happening. And it's nice. That kind of like odyssey is, it really took me back to that time and that recklessness and that abandon, and that anything could happen, youthfulness. And also, yeah, like I said, just so full of beauty. Probably the movie of the fest for me, the ones that I saw.
This is, as you're describing, it's also reminding me of a movie whose title I don't remember, but I know you love. There was that movie from like somewhere in Eastern Europe about like the dudes who go out and party all the time.
Oh yeah. All These Sleepless Nights.
That's right. Yeah.
All These Sleepless Nights. Which was on my top 10 of the 2010s list.
Nice. Yeah, because that's another movie that kind of like toes the line between like how much of this is documentary, how much of this is like set up fiction kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think you said, because you saw it at Sundance and it was like in the documentary section there, right?
Yeah, but like I think even as you're watching it, you're kind of like, this isn't totally documentary. But
exactly. Yeah.
But I do like that more filmmakers are kind of like exploring that line.
All right. So then I kicked off the second day, my full day, with, well, it started with a short called Realms that is so obscure that it's not like on, on the Letterboxd or IMDb. So I've already forgotten the like filmmakers' names, but it's just about a 4 or 5 minute short that is I think all women, and they are kind of like, it's kind of this medieval princess and dragon and magic wizard type of fantasy, and Natasha Khan, also known as Bat for Lashes, the musician, I don't know if you know Bat for Lashes.
I do not.
She's in it, and she plays an oracle anyway. All right. But I very quickly, when I got to the main feature, I very quickly saw why they picked Realms, because this one is also a medieval fantasy from a female point of view, but very different. The movie is called, it's from, I've already forgotten, god damn it. I navigated away from IMDb because I was looking for, here it is, 1976, it's called Un Rêve Plus Long Que La Nuit, or A Dream Longer Than the Night, which is a great title.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's about a little girl who in the opening scene goes to the wake of a family member and goes up to the body in the casket and steals a ring off his hand and puts it in her pocket.
Okay.
And that doesn't really come up plot wise, but it definitely does come up again. And then she goes home and she goes to sleep, and the rest of the movie is just like her dream. So she's a little girl and she's dreaming about being a princess, and she has a dragon that protects her, and she has a little like, I was mean because it is a little person, but I meant like a jester. To entertain her. And then within the dream, she is granted a wish and she wishes to be grown up. And almost immediately upon her being grown up, the movie becomes, in a very broad and sometimes very, very funny way, becomes super sexual.
Okay.
Where like she like went from being a princess as a girl to as a woman, she's essentially like treated as a concubine, and you've got all the men pretty much all the men in the movie represent some sort of soldier or figure of war. And they have like rockets and guns and stuff for penises.
All right.
And so it's just like, it's the movie is, I'm looking at the runtime here, 95 minutes, and it's all just endless like metaphor and symbolism, and it never stops being inventive and fun. Yeah, some of the humor is like I said, very broad, very French in some ways, but also some of it's quite risque. There's one of those like bomb or torpedo or missile penises gets a woman strokes it until it pops and a bunch sure. of like feathers pop out, okay. and the woman starts like picking up the feathers and rubbing them all over her face. That got a big laugh in the theater, but it's a strange movie. But the director's name is Nicky de Saint Phalle. Nicky de Saint Phalle, who was a multimedia artist. So I'm looking at IMDb, there's only a couple of like movies credited to her, but
she only directed one other feature and two shorts.
Yeah, but if you look her up on Wikipedia, wherever, she worked, you know, she was a sculptor and other things as well, and probably she probably made a lot of the things. But the restoration was actually sponsored by Dior, like the Christian Dior brand, because there's a fashion connection there. And the Q&A afterwards was with Laura Duke Condominas, who plays the grown-up little girl. By grown-up, I mean she's still probably only like 19 or whatever. She was there, and she was a delight, and like clearly loves movies, because she would. I like when someone like goes to a movie a film festival, as a guest or whatever, but it's like, I'm gonna take advantage and check out the movies, and that's what she did, and was talking about Gasoline Rainbow. all right, so yeah, that was really cool.
Okay. So this restoration I'm seeing is done by the Film Desk. Sometimes the releases can be hard to find, but I hope at least there being a digital version of it means it'll pop up eventually on like Criterion Channel or a movie or something like that. I'm just, you know, always try to give the listeners a sense of how they might one day be able to see these movies that we talk about that play at kind of these rare festivals. In addition to my own self-interest, at the very least, Film Desk now has an arrangement going with Vinegar Syndrome, where they release discs to them, though their editions can be quite expensive. But usually, they're being a digital edition. Hopefully, it means to pop up somewhere, because, I'm very intrigued by this film.
I want to say something about Vinegar Syndrome, but I don't like to say too much about my work or where I work in particular, but like, we do work with Vinegar Syndrome in some ways, which I love them, but it can be confusing, because Vinegar Syndrome is an actual thing that is bad for movie, like bad for celluloid, like
totally.
So like, there'll be things like in our inventory that are like marked Vinegar Syndrome, and it has caused like confusion in the past, where like someone's like, oh, this means do not use, and it's like, no, that's our master, the Vinegar Syndrome remaster. Like that's from their remaster.
It sounds like you guys need some additional metadata tags.
Always. you literally, you've hit on a sore spot with
me. I'm sure.
All right. Next movie. Okay. This festival was surprisingly funny, I would say.
Okay.
In the movies that I saw, especially the first, Gasoline Rainbow. Gasoline Rainbow is very funny. Un Repluto Pru Long Canuit is very funny. But then the one movie that I would definitely say is a comedy that I saw is Prashanth Kamalakanthan and Artemis Shaw's New Strains, which is... we were talking about, I saw the TV Globe being like tapping into like some nostalgia. This is a movie that I haven't looked up the technical specs or whatever, but appears to have been shot on like mini DV. So it reminded me of that, like around 2000, that era of like, you know, Chuck and Buck and Dancing in the Dark and stuff like that.
Totally.
So it had that look, which I'm very into.
The program listings on the festival website says it was shot on a Hi8 camera.
Okay, glad you have that up. So it's a movie about a couple. It takes place in, I guess, an alternate present where there has been an ongoing pandemic that is like COVID. They never say COVID, but it's basically a couple who have come to New York on vacation because her uncle has like a Manhattan loft or a big apartment that he's letting them stay in while he's out of town. So they come to New York on vacation, and almost immediately a new strain of whatever this ongoing pandemic is breaks out, and they're stuck back in lockdown. So the laughter in the theater for New Strains felt weirdly like cathartic.
Sure.
Like how it was like recreating things, but not making us relive the trauma of COVID, because this is a comedy where it's like some other thing, but that the strain, like, you know, people disinfecting their groceries and
sure,
making makeshift masks and all that kind of stuff got a lot of laughs. But even beyond that, the movie is just very funny, because it is about, you almost immediately sense that this couple is not going to be together very long, but of course then they're stuck together, so it becomes right. This like passive aggressive jealousy accusations, and then add to that this new strain of this fake pandemic causes people to deteriorate mentally, so they are also losing their shit in some ways at the same time. Yeah, incredibly funny movie, only 78 minutes. Yeah, I don't know. Hopefully you've discovered some sort of distribution.
Sadly, plan. There's nothing. No, I'm seeing that it doesn't have a distributor. I'm trying to find out where it might have premiered, though, and maybe it just like needs to run its cycle a little bit longer in order to get there. Because it sounds like, kind of a crowd pleaser, maybe something that Utopia would pick up. But yeah, I'm very intrigued by this.
Yeah, and it's basically so that the two actors are also the writer and directors. There's really only two other actors in the movie. There's the woman has a friend that she zooms with on multiple occasions, and then there's an added wrinkle is that the Artemis Shaw's character, her ex-boyfriend, lives in New York in the neighborhood that they're in. He is in the park when they're in the park and stuff like that. Yeah, very, very funny movie.
I'm very relieved to hear that there's an actually funny lockdown movie made at long last, because like I haven't seen many of those movies, but I've seen trailers for many of those movies that have like,
what are the funny ones? I'm trying to
remember. I'm saying that there haven't been. I'm saying like I mean
what are the ones that are trying to be funny, I guess.
Wasn't there the movie that was called like Together or something like that?
Yeah, but that was terrible, but it wasn't trying to be funny, I don't think.
Maybe my impression was supposed to be like kind of a comedy drama kind of situation. I just remember seeing a few trailers and like right as things were reopening, like we got our movie, it's gonna be about this thing that we all experienced, but it looked just awful.
And also I think some of them just tried too soon, just like they couldn't, I mean, people who made like that Together or whatever it's called, they couldn't have known about like Delta and Omicron and stuff like that when they made it, but because of that it felt like way too soon, and now it represents nothing. But yeah, this one I think has the benefit of coming out enough, you know, things have settled into sort of COVID is what it is now, ongoing. All right, so next up, this was another really cool a 1996 restoration of a movie called Naked Axe, directed by Brigitte M. Davis. Yes, not Bridget, Brigitte M. Davis. And it feels like a remnant of the like truly independent 90s that we don't really see anymore. The movie's about a woman who is, well, I'll tell, because I saved for the Q&A, I'll say what Bridgette M. Davis said about the, like, imagined the character. She said she imagined that, like, imagine that Dorothy Dandridge had a daughter, and that daughter was Pam Grier. And then Pam Grier had a daughter, and then that daughter was the main character. So basically she's like in this lineage of great stage and screen actors, or famous stage and screen actors. Her mom is known for like blaxploitation, and also known for taking off her top a lot in movies. And she and she has finally decided to become an actress because she has lost a bunch of weight. We learned that she was like a heavy kid and young adult, and she's like gone away and left New York, and she's lost a bunch of weight and is coming back to finally like be an actor. But she's like very insistent she's not going to do it the way her mom did. She's not going to do nudity. And then she gets cast in a movie, and the director is played by Ron Cephas Jones, who passed away just last year, is won a couple of Emmys for This Is Us most recently, but he's been acting for a long time. And is cast in the movie, and then almost immediately learns that the movie actually does require her to be to be naked. And so that ends up being sort of the journey of her journey of the movie, of like coming to terms with or deciding if she's going to do it, why she would do it, and also coming to terms with and letting other people know why she is so had been so insistent on not doing it. So it's this is one that's definitely not a comedy. It kind of feels like, if you look at like the one sheet on IMDb, it's like a naked woman covering herself up with strips of film. It looks like it could be like kind of a comedy, but it's definitely not. It gets to some very heavy stuff, and it all feels very independent, very 90s, very New York, but handled with a lot of sensitivity and insight, and definitely, I mean, is a movie that definitely plays into the ongoing discourse about nudity in movies that we're having today, which I think because I, you know, the characters, or some characters, differentiate between like exploitative nudity and artistic nudity, and our main character, at least early on, is saying no, it's all exploitation, and her journey is maybe towards like, I do think the movie ultimately makes a case for artistic nudity, that there is a use for it, and it is worthwhile, but it the character has to get there. So yeah, I mean, definitely not like breaking new ground cinematically. It's you know, it's not it's definitely more drama and character driven. Cool.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
I wanted to say the costumes are amazing. Funny thing to say about a movie that's so much about like nudity, but most of the movie, people are clothed in the costume.
Every time they take their clothes off, you're like, wish they'd kept that outfit a little longer.
Yeah. Go ahead.
This sounds awesome. It's looks like Kino has it, so it'll come to theaters and definitely digital formats down the line.
So it has a fascinating backstory that we learned. There's a woman named Maya Kane who has founded something called the Black Film Archive, which is what it sounds like.
Sure.
And so Bridgette M. Davis had trouble getting distribution for this movie at the time.
Because
I don't know. I think it's one of those things where it's like there was probably an idea in the 90s of what a black movie was, and this isn't that, even though it's a movie about black characters. So she ended up like, it ran for a couple weeks. She like four-walled the theater in New York City, and it ran for a couple weeks, and that was it. She did eventually like make a DVD at one point in the 2000s, but about a year and a half ago, this Maya Kane woman who runs the Black Film Archive, which Bridgette M. Davis, when she heard about the Black Film Archive, had gotten her film into there, and so Maya Kane just like like was going through the archive and was like, oh, I hadn't seen this. And she put it up and watched it and immediately reached out to Bridget M. Davis and was like, let's get you distribution. And a company called Milestone like decided to distribute it. I mean, like I said, it's a year and a half, which sounds like a long time, but it's like quite a quick turnaround for that.
Yeah, totally.
That sort of thing. And yeah, this was a great experience. The crowd loved it, which was very heartwarming to see Bridget M. Davis like get a response to the movie. Like this is, you know, the first time seeing it with a crowd of people who were really like there to see it, you know, in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It played a couple of festivals, but like this was, I don't think it had ever played on the West Coast before.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, seeing her reaction to us applauding, was very heartwarming.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, it's cool that a lot of these kind of like 80s, 90s independent, especially like black independent movies are getting kind of, you know, rescued can kind of sound like a colonialist term, but like getting a new life, a second life. Yeah. Now that the discourse has changed and like tastes have expanded, there's kind of a new market for those kind of films.
You mentioned the colonialist, but it should be pointed out that this movie was rescued by a black woman who runs the Black Film Archive.
Oh, totally. I guess I'm more thinking in terms of like the Milestone Kino Lorber connection in terms of getting a wide-ish audience. Yeah.
Okay. And then for a movie that I knew almost nothing about going in intentionally. It's called Dream Team. It's directed by Lev Kalman or Carmen and Whitney Kalman. Horn. Kalman, Whitney Horn.
Yeah.
Who, by the way, I do it on Blue Sky now. I keep a running thread of movies directed by women that I've seen throughout a year.
Okay.
And I am very careful to Google pronouns before I do that.
Sure.
I did not put this movie Dream Team on that list because no amount of Googling could tell me what Whitney Horn's pronouns are. So I don't know to this day.
Not enough interviews out there with just kind of incidentally referred to it?
Weirdly, it's... So I'm going to say they for now until I know any better. Clearly, they are not very into the interview thing because even when the directing team was speaking, he did all the speaking. And it was clearly like Whitney Horn's choice, because as they walked up to introduce the film, he had a mic and one of the festival people tried to hand Whitney Horn a mic and they were like, oh, no, thanks. So there are interviews with them, with the both of them, but like Lev Kalman is clearly like the mouthpiece. And then they talked in the post Q&A about how they work together, and like on set, that's clearly the case too, that he is more working with directors, and Whitney Horn is not only co-director but also the director of photography and the art director.
That's cool.
But they develop things completely together, even though they live in different cities. Lev Kalman lives in San Diego and Whitney Horn lives in San Francisco, and they develop their movies over like Zoom. This is the first one of the movies I'd seen. The only other one I'd heard of was Two Planes and a Fancy, which I think you said you saw.
I'm very fond of that movie. It's very weird and very like not absurdist in the way of like surrealness, but just like in the way people behave in the film. Big fan though.
Yeah, well, this is very absurd too. Yeah, their other movies are called L for Leisure and Blondes in the Jungle. Dream Team is, I think it's described as like kind of a parody of like syndicated cable, like erotic thriller TV series, like Silk Stockings. Silk Stockings is clearly a huge point. But if I say it parody, which is kind of how it went in, you might be thinking of something like me and Tyler favorite from like 6 years ago, Deep Murder, which is like a really good movie, but is like clearly like a parody, like clearly a comedy.
Right.
First, and this movie has funny stuff, but it's more surreal and absurd than that. But it was developed as a web series. Lev Kalman told the story, like, we developed this at a web series and tried to get it funded, and this was like in 2017, and everyone was like, no one makes those anymore. So they made it a feature, but they kept it essentially a web series, so it is 7 episodes.
I love this.
The funny thing about it, intentionally funny, is that it is open-ended. It reminded me of LaFleur in some ways, that is intentionally open-ended, because the seven episodes are a six-episode first season that airs that ends on a cliffhanger, and then the first episode of season two, which introduces a bunch of new characters, and then just ends.
Perfect.
Yeah, I love it. But yeah, the movie is very funny, but also very surreal and absurd. There's a lot of collage type editing, or sort of like either in camera or like sort of crude in a good way visual effects that you might that feel like something you might see in like experimental film from like the 60s or 70s. There's like there's a shot of a character boogie like longboarding out in the water, and then the image splits so that there are four of him. They're all doing the same thing, and then it comes back together. And within the reality of the TV show Dream Team, that is something that actually happened, but it also doesn't look real. It looks like a video effect. And so that's the sort of thing that happens. It reminded me of a movie that I saw at Sundance in 2020 that I don't know if it ever got distributed everywhere, anywhere. It was called Omniboat, which is an omnibus movie. Basically, this like Miami filmmaking art collective, like GoFundMe, someone buying them a speedboat, and then they just made like got a bunch of people to make like 20 something short films that all like kind of have to do with a speedboat, or at least have the speedboat in them.
Okay.
But again, I keep like thinking of comparisons, but Dream Team doesn't really compare directly to any of this stuff. In paying homage to the kind of like Silk Stockings type of thing, it does have a low budget, like production value look to it.
Well, but I also imagine that just based on who's involved in the general description of it.
But also, they did real location shooting, and a lot of it takes place in Baja California. So they shot in Rosarito, and they shot in Tijuana, and they shot at the Valle de Guadalupe. But those are mostly exteriors. I guess they said like the whatever, like no matter what, where stuff's supposed to take place, if it's interior, they probably shot it in San Diego. Most of the movie was shot in San Diego, but they went down to Mexico to shoot a bunch of exteriors, which is very cool and looks great. And so I've mentioned a lot of things. I keep mentioning Silk Stockings, and I should point out that the movie is very much like in that erotic vein.
Yeah.
But it manages to walk this line of being like very funny and knowing in the erotic elements, but also like it's still sexy. Like it's still a sexy movie at the same time. And it also has, you are going to learn more than you would think about marine biology.
I was not expecting that sentence just now.
No, yeah, it has a couple of characters who are marine biologists who like just explain things. And apparently this was inspired by, there's an Australian kids show. There was an Australian kids show called H2O Just Add Water. That was like this fantasy about mermaids, but it was also educational. So it would be like mermaids, like, oh, am I going to get the boy to like me? But also they would stop and just like say, you know, here's what algae is, and here's how plankton works and stuff like that. So I guess they kind of took inspiration from this Australian kids show. Anyway, the movie was a delight. I hope people get to see it. And I definitely like Two Planes and a Fancy is on. We've joked about my like watch lists and how there are multiple lists, and I'll, the master list for all the lists, but I'll never get to all of them. Two Planes and a Fancy is definitely on one of my lists, but I think I'm going to have to bump it up because I was really, really into Dream Team.
Yeah. So this looks like it has distribution through Yellowvale Pictures, which is a very small outfit, but they put out We Kill for Love, which is a documentary you saw last year. And just right now they have a film out called Riddle of Fire that I've heard good things about. And it seems like they have, this is another company that has like a DVD Blu-ray distribution deal with Vinegar Syndrome. Okay. So this will come out in some capacity, I would imagine, this year. And I'm very much looking forward to it.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, me too. All right. Okay. Sorry, just got to text message. All right, but I guess what's that?
I said, is it important?
It is, but it's not urgent. It's important, but not urgent. Okay, so the final film that I saw is one that you've seen because you are a big Chantal Ackerman head. And this is a new restoration of Chantal Ackerman's 1972?
No, it's 80s, isn't it?
Oh, 82. Yeah. Yes, I knew it was a two at the end. 1982 movie, Toute une nuit, or I guess the English title is One Whole Night.
Yeah, the file I watched this via an illicit download, and they translated it as A Whole Night.
Okay, A Whole Night, yeah.
Yeah.
But I've talked too much. Why don't you talk a little bit since you've seen this one?
Oh, gosh. It wants a very simple film to describe, but also, like, I don't know, somewhat complex, because it's basically, I mean, as the film, the title suggests, it takes place over the course of seemingly a night, although it could also be like any night over the course of a reasonably temperate summer, perhaps maybe like spring or fall. There's no immediate sense that all these events are taking place simultaneously, other than the aesthetic suggestion and the general climate of it all. But it basically like it takes place in Brussels, and trying to figure out how many people are in the cast. The best I could come up with is that it's over two dozen. And it's essentially these like little vignettes of people kind of in various stages of love affairs, either relationships or hookups or breakups or long-term relationships or anything else. And just like, it really taps into that feeling of being awake at, you know, 2, 3, 4 a.m. and thinking about your life, reassessing things, wondering what the people that you're most intimately involved with are really thinking, wondering how secure your life is, and dreaming about the possibilities that might exist out in the world. Appropriately, I watched this last night in the middle of the night when I couldn't sleep, which really added to the atmosphere of it, but which would be a very pleasurable viewing anytime, and which is like at once kind of an expansion of a lot of things that Chantal Ackerman has done before, but also very much new territory that I would not have predicted. When I kind of heard like the basic thematic premise of this, I assumed it was about a couple. And it wasn't until watching that I was like, oh, this is about like a whole subject. There's very little dialogue in it. It's mostly about people's behavior. Some of which is like, as you would expect, Chantal Ackerman, very still and very patient. And some of which is like, there's people dancing, or like in a very memorable sequence, two people run out of a bar and like knock over their beers and then make out. There's all these kind of great little touches to it that kind of tap into, yeah, like I said, that feeling of either waking up in the middle of the night or being up all night or wandering in the streets, and just that very like dusk till dawn sense of like anything is possible.
I think, is this you mentioned people running out of bar? Yeah, there's running out of bar, but is that a different one? There's the shot, there's a woman standing in front of a bar,
mm-hmm.
and then she decides to leave, and then we see the guy inside at the bar notice her, and then he runs out to catch her and is like, I was waiting for you, and she was like, I didn't know that, and then she keeps walking. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Vaguely.
She keeps walking, and then he like hails a cab.
Yes.
And the cab like pulls up immediately.
This is so great.
He gets in the back. The cab pulls ahead to where she is.
Yeah.
He opens the back door, grabs her by the arm, and pulls her into the cab, and then the cab speeds off. The entire scene is like 25 seconds, and it's hilarious.
This is the kind of stuff that's like, I mean, it's like, it feels like a bigger film than she's made before, certainly before this. Maybe like Golden 80s could be on similar scale with like the number of people involved. And that's a lot more of like an interrelated environment. But this is like a surprisingly ambitious film for its kind of simple setup. But it's also like has all the kind of like lockdown beauty of Chantal Ackerman's. I remember there's one shot in particular where like a little girl runs out in the street, but because like everything's dark, like the street and the night have like the same color temperature almost, it feels like she's just like in a void.
There's, it's amazing. I couldn't even really put my finger on how she was doing it, but there's such a sense of atmosphere despite everything being still and dark. Like you mentioned it being summer, and I was like, yeah, it absolutely is summer. I don't know, but it felt like a hot night.
Yeah, it had
I don't know that.
It's partially because like how people are dressed, you know?
Right. Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah. It's not like they're out there sweating, but at the same time, you get that sense of like kind of a warmer climate.
Yeah, fantastic. I was going to say something else about it, and now I have forgotten. Another movie that left me kind of heartbroken at the end. It has a sad sort of grace note at the end, I think.
Yeah, it's an interesting, I mean, I don't want to like, I don't know, saying like there's a spoiler for Toot and Weed, it feels like the wrong way to approach it, but at the same time, it does end on a note that feels sad, but also the dialogue is kind of strangely hopeful, and I'll be curious to actually talk to you maybe off mic about the particulars of how that gets executed, because I think I took a slightly more hopeful tone from it. But, you know, I think it's pretty on par with what you would expect from Chateau Ackerman. The idea that there are possibilities beyond where specifically the film ends while not totally resolving what the film's been about.
Here's what I wanted to ask you.
Okay.
Because you are an expert in both Chateau Ackerman and Godard.
Okay.
The two young men and the young woman in the bar early on, is that supposed to evoke Band of Outsiders? Because that's what I thought of immediately.
I mean, I feel like anytime, yeah, you've got that kind of setup, you're going to think of Band of Outsiders.
But I mean, even the shot of like they're at, and maybe it's just because bars in France and Belgium maybe actually just all look like this, but like they're at tables against the wall, there are mirrors behind them, they're at two separate tables. The framing even looked like that period of Godard. And so it felt like, it felt like it was some sort of nod.
Maybe. I didn't immediately think of it, is all I can say.
Well, if you didn't, then I guess I'm crazy.
No, that doesn't mean you're crazy. It means I was up at 5 a.m. and just wanted to watch Toot and Weed. It doesn't necessarily mean that I was most attentive to those particular references.
All right, well, that's all I saw. Another movie called Good One that if I saw The TV Glow, which I did. Now, if I saw The TV Glow was my favorite movie that I saw at Sundance, my second favorite movie is Good One, directed by India Donaldson. And that played on Sunday, but I didn't go because I've already seen it. But really great movie. But you guys heard me talk about it on the Sundance wrap-up. But I don't know if you have any Good One distribution notes.
On the festival website it says it's a Metrograph release, which means that it will come out in some capacity, although I can't remember the last like new film they distributed, but the restorations they've distributed do tend to come out. So
okay, well, good. All right, well, you can find us at battleshippretention.com, email me at david@battleshippretention.com, email Tyler at Tyler@battleshippretention.com. I'm on Twitter and Blue Sky at Davy Pretension, on Letterboxd at David Backs, and my other podcast is about TV. It's the one where I met your mother, which I do with my wife, and she's cooler than I am, so you should listen to it. Scott, where can people find you?
On Twitter, Rail of Tomorrow, Blue Sky, Rail of Tomorrow, on Letterboxd, and I don't think I have any new review. Oh no, I will have a review to plug this week for Chicken for Linda, a very charming French animated film. Okay. And that's about it.
All right, well, thank you for at home for listening,
and we'll get you next time.
Bye.